Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. Today we have Kay Heimowitz with us. She is the William Simon Fellow at the Manhattan Institute and a contributing editor at City Journal, where she's been publishing for a long time. One of the regular writers at that distinguished journal. Her books include Liberation's Children, Parents and Kids in a Postmodern Age from 2004, and Manning Up, How the Rise of Women Has Turned Men into Boys. That was 2011. I have to tell you, okay, first of all, welcome. Thank you for joining us. But I have to tell you, a friend of mine read that book in 2011. She was actually finishing up in academia. She says, Kay Heimowitz is now my hero. So I think that caught on.
When you write a book like that, you make a lot of enemies.
Well, sometimes you approach those topics. If you're not making enemies, maybe you're not saying anything meaningful. What was it? There's one Rusty quoted this person the other day saying, as an editor of a journal, you should make 20% of your readers angry, but it's important that you not make them the same 20%
every
time.
Every time, yes.
Okay, be interesting, unpredictable.
That makes sense.
Anyway, she wrote an essay in the latest issue in City Journal, recently under the aptly single word title, Alone. Alone. And it's a pretty powerful examination of a social affliction hitting us right now. I'm gonna read the first paragraph of the essay just to set the tone, if I may. And it goes, Americans are suffering from a bad case of loneliness. The number of people in the United States living alone has gone through the studio apartment roof. A study released by the insurance company Cigna last spring made headlines with its announcement, quote, only around half of Americans say they have meaningful daily face-to-face social interactions, unquote. Loneliness, public health experts tell us, is killing as many people as obesity and smoking. It's not much comfort that Americans are not, well, alone in this. Germans are lonely. The bon vivant French are lonely. And even the Scandinavians, the happiest people in the world, according to the UN's World Happiness Report, are lonely too. British Prime Minister Theresa May recently appointed a, quote, minister of loneliness. Now, I read that first paragraph and said, is there really a minister of loneliness in the UK? Wow.
Well, we'll see if he or she stays on.
Right, right.
The changes going on.
But look, this has to be taken seriously, obviously. And what you lay out here is quite a pile of hard evidence for the loneliness epidemic. Maybe we'll go to background. What motivated you on this?
I have written about the family and family breakdown for many years now, and
maybe I should say that the subtitle is "The Decline of the Family Has Unleashed an Epidemic of Loneliness."
Yes, and I was trying to figure out what was happening that was new. What kind of new research was there? What had I not weighed in on? And I happened to stumble across an article that I quote in the article. Proceedings of the, I'm going to get the name of it wrong, but one of a demographic and scientific journal. And it was an eye-opener. It said that there was an increase in the number of percentage of people who were kinless. That is, they had no brothers, sisters, mothers, fathers, cousins, aunts, uncles. And that this was having a huge public health impact. So they were particularly, by the way, concerned about what was happening to blacks, where kinlessness was especially bad. And I got curious about this and started to think about it, started to look at it. And then, of course, there were so many people talking about loneliness as a new issue that I thought, well, now, wait a minute. You know, family, loneliness. Obviously, there's a connection, and I decided that I would try to draw that out a little bit.
You know, we'll come back to this. Just mentioned this story in the New York Times Magazine from 2015 called "The Lonely Death of George Beall." Well, we'll get back to it. But first, what you just said, the connection between family breakdown, kinlessness, and loneliness. You refer in the essay to, quote, the studied cultural silence about marriage, children, and kinship. What is that?
Well, I think that's what I mentioned at the end, because you're trying to think about, well, what can be done? And I had always observed, and this is not only me, actually, but Charles Murray, for instance, that the people who were well off, people who were of the, you know, educated class, and the people that I knew and were my peers, their kids were doing pretty well after lots of concerns through the teenage years and all that stuff. And they married late, but they married. Now they're having children. And the parents are just ecstatic with these grandchildren. Now, these were parents who never would have said to their kids growing up, you'll want to marry and have children. It's a wonderful thing. It is an aspiration that you shouldn't be embarrassed about, because the culture is telling you you should be independent, you shouldn't be needy, mm-hmm. so on and so forth. And it was telling young women, you should be a little ambivalent about having children, certainly, because it wasn't going to help your career to mm-hmm. have children. And I think that their silence about this issue is representative of a broader cultural reticence on this topic, particularly among the elites, and that it hasn't helped people who don't have our advantages.
Is feminism a big part of that?
I think so. Yeah. I think so. The more that I look at this issue of loneliness, kinlessness, decline in fertility, the workism that we see everywhere among the educated classes, the more I think, feminism, a lot of it goes back to feminism. Now, feminism could not have existed without this second demographic transition that I talk about in the piece.
That was actually one of my next questions. You make a lot of the quote, and this is a technical term,
yes.
right? The second demographic transition, what is that?
So there were two major demographic transitions in our history. One was when the birth rate and death rate both went down right around the start of the Industrial Revolution. People started to have smaller families, but they lived longer, and that was considered the first demographic transition. But in the 60s, around the 60s, mid-century, we started what they call the second demographic transition. And what happened there, according to the experts on this, is that after World War II, as the Western world became more prosperous, more affluent, as people could afford to live on their own more, as birth control became more reliable, and therefore women less dependent on men, and sex less dependent on marriage, you began to see this tremendous transition in family forms, non-conventional family forms. Mm-hmm. So that's how they explain, these are demographers and sociologists, explain what happened it's the sexual revolution, but with a different focus, slightly different focus, and an understanding also that this was went across the board. This wasn't just in the United States. Because sometimes when I read people talk about the 60s, there's a tendency to think this was just something sui generis to the United States, and it certainly was not. Mm-hmm. It had different impacts, but related impacts elsewhere.
Remember when Murphy Brown brought everyone onto the set and said, "Mr. Vice President, families come in all shapes and sizes." And you want to say, "Well,
let's see how that goes."
Would she include a single person living alone at age 65? Is that a family too?
Yeah, I just was reading about a woman who was having a celebration because she was going to marry herself.
Okay. It'll be a lasting relationship. So, what happens if she starts to not like herself? Does she go through the same, divorce? Will there be only one lawyer or two?
I sense a market here.
Indeed. So the second demographic transition, we were living in the wake of that.
Yes, we are. And the way that I got into talking about this SDT is an unfortunate abbreviation,
right.
It was related to feminism, because feminism was part of the ideology, ideational background of, or the grease, if you will, of the second demographic transition. In other words, Westerners embraced the ideology that went along with the second demographic transition, because in and of itself, it wouldn't have to have happened the way it did. But they liked the freedom. People really embraced the freedom, the self-expression, and so forth that they found through the affluence that was. By the way, I just want to mention one thing that I realized very recently, not when I was writing the piece, that the dominant conversation about the breakdown of the family has to do with the end of the manufacturing sector and the loss of jobs for less educated men. This turns that on its head and says, actually, no, it's societal affluence that leads to the breakdown of family, because you're not as dependent for survival.
That's an important point to make. You know, you say on the SDT, in translating family formation into a strictly private matter, the SDT whistled past a crucial fact of our history, namely that kinship has been the most powerful glue of human group since Homo sapiens first discovered the mother-in-law.
That's a nice
punctuation there on that. But you say they translated family formation into a strictly private matter. Now, I'm a late boomer. You know, I'm one of the last years of the baby boomer. So I can't imagine family formation being anything but a strictly private matter. What was it? I mean, you talk about a glue, a bigger glue. How was the family more than just a private matter?
Well, number one, it had an immensely important social purpose. And the way that I see it is going back, to our human beginnings, that the marriage and family solved a particular social problem. And that problem was the survival of the next generation. So what do you do to ensure that survival if you're in these groups and there's not a lot of reliable food and protection? What I think became clear was that humans were pair bonders, that they did seem to have that instinct in them. And that you would have more survival if you had men, fathers, tied to their pair bondee, and the children. And that's, to me, where the idea for the family and the necessity of the family came from. There were all sorts of side benefits to this, one of them being that it was very, it domesticated men.
Right. So without you, we'd just be 35-year-old teenagers.
Oh, definitely.
Or
well,
worse.
That's what's happening.
That's what's happening. Basic survival, the perpetuation of the group. Is this what Hungary and Italy are discovering? With the state actually starting to produce tremendous state-sponsored incentives, economic incentives. Having kids. This is, family formation. We're looking at survival here.
Survival of a group, yes.
Of a particular group here. And so that's what makes fundamentally family formation a bigger thing.
Right.
Not a strictly private
matter.
Now,
in more advanced societies like our own, it has other implications because it appears now, we know from 40 or 50 years of experimentation, that children, in fact, are going to do better in an advanced society when they grow up with two parents in a stable environment. And that tends to be when they're married. We can go into the differences if you're interested in other family forms. But the point is that the kids it isn't just survival, it is now thriving. And that we're looking at, and marriage seems to make a big difference there as well. And somehow the elites, and I was of the older boomer generation, a little older than you, and we just, didn't foresee any of this. And of course, as these decades have gone on, people are even more blind to it.
In 1969, the grand visionary experimentalists, these people were doing their experiments, they had no idea that the consequences might go very, very bad.
Yeah.
They were just fired up.
Right. The irony is that it helped to produce more inequality. That's my reading of it. And I remember, as I argued, the demographers of the second demographic transition was a result of societal affluence. Yeah, but it also led to more inequality because you had the people who were, better able to deal with the chaos around them, the scriptlessness, if you will, that is the lack of rules and regulations and shared understanding.
Maybe the top 20%, maybe, who could handle, sort of, they had somehow internalized the Protestant work ethic and bourgeois goal, delayed gratification.
Right.
Are working class women better off after the sexual revolution?
I
don't want to generalize too much.
Yeah, but. I'm in the middle of reading an interesting book right now called We're Still Here, and it's by an academic who went and lived in a coal town in Pennsylvania. I think it was after Trump was elected, or it might have been right before. And I will say, if these stories are representative, women had a put up with a lot. There was a lot of abuse. There still is. Mm-hmm. And I mean, maybe it's worse now. I don't know.
Yeah.
That's what the data would suggest from what we know, that there's more domestic violence when you're cohabiting with somebody than if you're married.
Well, one thing I was going to ask, you have one quote. Marriage creates kin, cohabitation does not.
Yes.
Now, come on. Yeah, this is the 21st century now. I mean, why do we need some sacramental, religious, or even civil, official process? Can't we just live together and be devoted to one another, and that'll produce kinship?
Right. So evidently not. That's nice. Because we, again, the data is in. Cohabiting couples just don't have the same kind of relationship with their children's grandparents that married couples do. They're not family exactly. Now, are there exceptions? I'm sure there are people who have been together for decades. I know one in particular, but that's common law marriage, what they used to call common law marriage, and they are definitely family. But
Susan Sarandon and Tim Robbins, they're the model cohabitating couple. They've been together for...
Oh, they broke up.
Wait a minute, they broke up. but they were the standard bearers. We don't need marriage.
Well, Mark, to be fair, they are Hollywood actors, so the rules are different out there.
Now, one thing that is curious here, the leading voices of the liberatory individualism tended to be the come out of the elite intellectual or entertainment media circles.
Yeah.
And I mean, are the well-off, or somehow the well-off are, they may be more in tune with the trends of the individualism, but they don't act that way.
No,
I mean, in their private lives, at least. Right. Are they conscious of the contradiction? They just kind of. Well, everyone should be free to do whatever they want, to cohabit however they want, but sort of they soften that with, but you know.
Well, they're more concerned, I think, with judging people who go a different path, and also because it's now so the cohabiting parents, the single mothers are generally, but not always, associated with lower class, that they don't want to judge them. It sounds very paternalistic, and they're quite uncomfortable with that, I think. And I think, well, the honest truth is, I don't think they give it much thought. Mm-hmm. They're thinking about their own children and their success, and they're happy to brag about it,
right.
You know.
And if only everyone would be like them, liberalism would, this sort of cultural liberalism, it would work.
Right, so they also have the benefit of bourgeois restraint that's been passed down over generations and that they're passing down to their children. Now, maybe some of this is genetic, you know? I mean, maybe some people have an easier time, they have more impulse control and they pass that down too. But I don't think so. I think this is a value-laden thing. And of course, the 60s was very anti-bourgeois. Actually, it started before the 60s, as our friend Fred Siegel has written about, the hostility to bourgeois values. But I think what we boomers didn't understand was just what an achievement that restraint was, mm-hmm. and how necessary it was to decent life. And that's what you're not seeing among the less educated classes, where the opioid crisis is just out of control, the alcohol abuse, domestic violence, and so on and so forth.
What is gray divorce? You mentioned that on the third page of your essay.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. The boomers were, I call them Generation Zero for divorce. I mean, they really went wild when the divorce revolution started. It was their revolution. You know, the divorce rate went way, way up in the 1970s, and it actually plateaued. It evened out for a while after that, and it's even gone down, believe it or not. And I can tell you why that's not the good news it sounds like in a moment. But they were...
Is that because fewer people are getting married?
Exactly. You filled it in nicely. But at any rate, they're still getting divorced. You know, the boomers are the ones who are where the divorce rates are going up. If you look by generation, younger generation kids are not, they're not divorcing at the same rates that their parents or grandparents, is it now, did. And so gray divorce is the term that some pop sociologists, I guess, thought of to describe the later in life divorce, which is very common.
So these may be maybe perhaps even more prosperous. They've held it together because of the kids.
Probably.
Kids are out the door. Hey, now, you know.
Probably.
I had that restraint. I respected that bourgeois restraint, but now, you know, I'm 60. I'm not, you know.
Right.
I'm
I have another 20, 30 years. Yeah, I'm gonna.
And that before that there, whatever the forms of individualism, that they weren't as strong. If you're 60 years old in 1950, you don't look upon your life in the same way a 60-year-old would today.
That is right. Now, there's also the fact that probably a 60-year-old today is healthier,
right.
Or at least a well-off 60-year-old is healthier,
right.
And has more years to look ahead to, but also can count. Nobody can count on health for all that time, but you know, there's a better chance that they'll remain healthy and vigorous. And they got a life to live.
Exactly.
So I think that it has to play a role. But I also think it's what you said, that people are thinking, look, I wanted to do right by my kids, and I did. What they don't know is that this this is quite disruptive to families anyway, even if it's a gray divorce.
One of the stunning illustrations of the loneliness epidemic that you bring up is what is called the lonely death.
Yeah.
What is the lonely death?
Terribly sad. So with the increase in kinlessness, that is, with people who have no relatives left, and by the way, this is more likely to be men than women. We can discuss why.
Did they tended never to marry and never to have kids?
Well, this is particularly common among blacks, so not only, you know, disproportionate among blacks, but not limited to them by any means. Yes, because the black marriage rate is very low. So what you find is a lot of black men who are aging, they've been alienated from their children and from the children's mothers. Their parents are dead. Maybe they have a sibling somewhere or maybe not. But I recall sitting with a friend of mine at dinner when her husband said, and he was a doctor, a cancer doctor, who worked in a Philadelphia hospital, inner city hospital, and he said he was noticing how many black men came in for treatment with nobody. Mm-hmm. I've talked to
next of kin, zero.
Right.
Person to contact in case of emergency.
Maybe they'll put a neighbor in or something. You'll find very peculiar ways of dealing with this. I remember reading about one woman who died alone, and the only person that she knew to mention to people that should be notified of her death was the woman who delivered the drugs to her from the drugstore for her, because she couldn't leave the house.
One paragraph where you talk about a particular lonely death that was profiled in the New York Times shows the degree to which the absence of kin has to be handled by the state.
Absolutely.
And here's a death like Bell's. This is a man who died. No one even knew. It went on for weeks. His body ended up being decomposed body. A death like Bell's mobilizes an impressive cadre of officials in addition to junk removers and cleaners, a medical examiner who calls local doctors and hospitals to see if anyone has records for the deceased, a medical legal investigator to rule out foul play, police detectives to track down close relatives or friends by calling phone numbers found in papers strewn around the apartment, and when that fails, quote, a decedent property agent who disposes of unclaimed property, a kinship investigator required by law to find next of kin down to first cousin once removed, and employees of both the city chosen funeral home and crematory. That's a huge machinery of the state that could be solved with one family member.
Yes.
Or at least simplified.
Yes.
Tremendously.
Absolutely.
One family. Yeah. So there we see a public cost to the family breakdown.
Absolutely.
Right there.
Absolutely. Well, we can add that to the family courts.
Right.
You know, foster care and so on and so forth.
Right. One thing you notice about a lot of these lonely deaths is many of them are hoarders.
Yes.
They've got piles and piles of stuff. Why does loneliness, is there a relationship between the hoarding and the isolation people feel?
Well,
if you want to speculate on
right. As a literature major, I thought there was some symbolism there, yes. That it was a kind of a symbol of what it felt like inside to be abandoned the way they were. Now, I will say that hoarding is very common among the elderly, and you'd have to talk to a psychiatrist to maybe they know more about it than I do, but this seems to be particularly out of control, these kinless folks.
No, my father was a pathological hoarder from actually a very young age, in fact. Okay. So let's conclude, Kay. Where are we going to be on this loneliness epidemic? I mean, epidemics, they run their course in certain ways. Where do you see this going?
Well, I don't see given the fertility rate and the fact that that rate keeps going down, given the collapse of the family in a broad section of the population, I don't see it going away. Mm-hmm. And I do see a growing state to take over a lot of the responsibilities of the family. And of course, the healthcare system will be burdened by this as well.
And an increasing division, economic division,
yes.
social division between that 20%
yes.
who, again, has the resources or whatever the sensibilities to avoid,
right,
and the others,
right,
you know,
the
gap will grow,
right. So I don't see any inclination on the part of elites and the political class to take this on.
I never hear a politician talking about
this. No, they at this point their constituency is.
These aren't voters, right?
Yeah.
A lot of times.
What are they gonna do?
But
yeah.
I imagine the lonely crowd. They're probably not. I bet their voting rates are their civic engagement.
Absolutely.
Is awfully low.
Yes, we have data on that.
So why worry about them
if
you're in politics?
Yeah, and an awful lot of the Trump voters, I think, hadn't voted. Earlier, because they were actually very disengaged, but then they became energized by a man who seemed to understand their loss, their anger, even if he didn't always express it very well.
Indeed, indeed. All right, well, thank you, Kay, for joining us.
Thank you.